You're tuned to WFHB.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Good afternoon. Reporting remotely for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Sarah Vaughn. This is the WFHB local news for Monday, October 12th, 2020.
Our main driving force as far as, you know, the petition that we had is the building is beyond repair.
Later in the program, you will hear coverage on the demolition of the former Players Pub site on South Walnut Street. You will hear from the latest Bloomington Historical Preservation Commission meeting later in the program.
We do view door-to-door trick-or-treating as not advisable in this time.
Also coming up in the next half hour, a few minutes with the mayor, where WFHB Assistant News Director Sydney Foreman poses questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton on local issues. But first, your daily headlines.
With the headlines you need to know today, we turn to WFHB correspondent Aaron Conforti, who filed today's local news brief.
From WFHB, this is the local news brief for Monday, October 12th. I'm Aaron Conforti. Almost 1,600 new cases of COVID-19 were reported in Indiana on Sunday, according to the Indiana State Department of Health. That's slightly higher than the state's moving average, which is at an all-time high. Six new COVID-related deaths were added to the state's tally as well, and today, with more than 1,200 hospitalizations, there are more Hoosiers hospitalized because of COVID-19 than at any other time since mid-May. Locally, Monroe County saw 27 newly confirmed cases yesterday, which is just about the county's moving average. Monroe County's numbers represent a significant drop in new cases since the middle of last month. Surrounding counties saw between 1 and 20 new cases. Indiana University reported about 2,900 positive COVID-19 test results since testing began in mid-August. The university's website does not state how many of those positive tests belong to unique individuals, so we don't know what the positivity among unique individuals is. It is one of the primary metrics that the federal government requires COVID-19 testing facilities to report. And positivity among unique individuals is almost always higher than positivity rates from all testing, which includes repeat testing of the same people. According to the university, for the past 4 weeks, however, positivity has been trending downward across all testing categories at Indiana University Bloomington. The downward trend at the university notably contrasts from the state's upward trend. And police rearrested Alan Montgomery in his hospital room on Saturday evening and brought him back to the Monroe County Jail in downtown Bloomington. Montgomery had been hospitalized last week after an apparent self-harm incident at the Monroe County Jail. The jail's public liaison confirmed that after Montgomery's hospitalization, Judge Darcy Fawcett released him from the jail's custody. The liaison wouldn't comment on whether Montgomery was released so that the jail could avoid responsibility for the potential death of a person in its custody. That's all for your local news brief from WFHB. I'm Aaron Conforti.
Amy Coney Barrett, nominee for the U.S. Supreme Court, faces scrutiny from her involvement with the religious group People of Praise. Former members criticized the group's ultra-conservative views on women. Meanwhile, defenders said scrutinizing her affiliation to a mostly Catholic group borders on anti-religious bigotry. Coral Annika Thiel, a former member of the group, told Amy Goodman on Democracy Now! That she considers the organization a cult.
I was a member of the People of Praise. Many call it a community, but I describe it as a cult in Corvallis, Oregon. I experienced abuse and torture by my husband, Marty Warner, Independence, Oregon, and the cult leaders, as well as shunning, shaming, and a smear campaign against me when I escaped and left. For safety, I legally changed my name and have lived under a state address protection program from my ex-husband for the past 20 years. Even though I was, I left the People of Praise cult, I didn't have any rights due to being married to my husband, who was a cult member. I was under the authority of my husband and his authoritarian head, Ed Brown. Under their authority, I was forced to attend meetings, but because I had defied leadership and their authority, I was forced to sit on the floor outside of their meetings in the hallway at the St. Mary's Catholic Church. There's dozens of witnesses that have seen how I was treated. What I would ask listeners to consider, even though they say this is a healthy group, to consider how I was treated and if this would be correct for Amy Barrett to be treated.
People of Praise was founded in South Bend, Indiana in 1971. The group has grown into a community of about 1,700 members in 22 cities across the U.S., Canada, and the Caribbean, according to its website. Another former member, Rachel Coleman, told the Associated Press, quote, "I don't think membership in the group is disqualifying. I think she needs to be open and transparent about it," end quote. Barrett has yet to speak publicly about her connection to the group. The AP documented Barrett and her family's involvement, including an old directory that listed Barrett as one of the organization's handmaids, or women leaders. AP also reported she was a trustee at one of the group's Trinity schools, and she lived in a house owned by one of the group's co-founders. Coral Annika Thiel talked about having a miscarriage and how she was forced to attend a handmaidens meeting afterward.
One time I had a miscarriage in 1984, and I had to have a DNC surgery. After I returned from the hospital, I was forced to attend a People of Praise women's meeting, our handmaidens meetings. I had a head that was also a woman besides my husband. They wanted to go shopping, and I couldn't due to returning from surgery and feeling weak. I left the meeting to go home and rest as my doctor had ordered. I was met by my husband and forced into the car, kidnapped against my will, where I was driven to the cult leader's home. I was interrogated until wee hours of the morning and psychologically abused. The next morning, the community was informed to shun me. I would never allow anyone to treat me this way today, and it traumatizes me to admit this was my life at that time.
Amy Goodman asked Thiel about her decision to leave People of Praise and how the religious group responded.
Well, I never wanted to join in the first place, but due to our marriage, I was forced to obey in all things through the duration of our 20-year marriage, but during the 5 years, especially in the People of Praise cult, I was just forced to obey. And yes, we had Sunday meetings. We had women had Tuesday night meetings. The men had Thursday night meetings. There was community meetings on to help people within the community. There's not a lot of outside contact. In fact, our leaders would tell us how often we could see our family and our friends. And even the night my father died in 1984, he did not allow me to go see my father before he died. Those were just decisions made. And as I will say, the bottom line was cruelty. And members are in spiritual bondage. Some are afraid to leave. I believe I was an example. Perpetrators will show people what happens to others when you say no. It's very similar to domestic violence and how frightening an experience it is to leave. And I was shunned in the community, and because the People of Praise community in Corvallis had a widespread respect within the community, many of their members are leaders in the local St. Mary's Catholic Church, I was shunned even in stores. There was people who knew them, and so it was a very traumatic experience.
Barrett will testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee on Monday. Her involvement in the religious group will likely be a factor, as critics say her appointment to the Supreme Court may restrict or even knock down legalized abortion.
Monroe County Health Administrator Penny Caudill announced a new COVID-19 testing site during the October 19th COVID-19 press conference. She reported the new site is a partnership between the County Health Department, Monroe County, City of Bloomington, Indiana University Health, and the university.
The state has came to the local health departments late this summer to offer some, what really was very small seed money for testing, for a community testing site. And a lot of counties did not do it because it wasn't enough to really cover the costs. And when we brought that to the commissioners and to this group, the commissioners were in right away. And this group was, we need to pursue this. Even if it doesn't work out, we really need to pursue it and make it happen if at all possible. And so we're pleased today to be able to say that those agreements and the details are being worked out, and we are moving forward to bring that testing site.
Caudill mentioned the testing site could perform 200 tests per day and would remain open through June of 2021. Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton said a federal Coronavirus Aid, Relief, and Economic Security Act appropriation would provide the city's portion of funding for the testing center. He mentioned Indiana's positivity rate has increased.
As I look at the state's website, just checking it today, the seven-day moving average of positive cases is up 50% in Indiana in the last month. Saying that again, the seven-day moving average of how many positive cases we're seeing each day in the state of Indiana has gone up 50% in the past month at its highest level ever, according to the state website. It's been rising since the governor announced his planned changes, including eliminating the mask mandate and other loosening of restrictions.
Indiana University Health South Central Region Outreach Program Director Shauna Gerges mentioned a rise in COVID-19 inpatients in Lawrence County. She reported Muncie and Lafayette hospitals also experienced a high volume of inpatients. Also during the press conference, Monroe County Emergency Management Director Allison Moore stated Halloween activities should follow Centers for Disease Control guidelines. She mentioned safe locations for children to trick or treat.
We do have several safe places in the community that are willing to hand out candy, and we have a list of some of those places, and most of those are fire stations that are willing to hand out candy for us that have been made aware of the CDC guidelines, and we'll be following those. And so if you want to participate in Halloween trick-or-treating and want to go to places that you are assured are going to be following CDC guidelines, you can check that list out on the county homepage. And I will put that in the chat. It is co.monroe.in.us.
Indiana University Assistant Vice President of Strategic Partnerships, Kirk White, reported the fourth week of declining COVID-19 positivity rates.
In RPS, in our residence halls, we went from 1.5 down to 1.2%. Greek housing went from 2.1 to 1.6, and off campus 0.9 to 0.5.
White stated IU is in the sixth percentile of universities across the country with over 5,000 students which perform regular mitigating tests.
The Bloomington Historical Preservation Commission is considering the demolition of 424 and a half South Walnut Street, the former home of the Players Pub restaurant and bar. Historical Preservation Program Manager Connor Hederich discussed the building's historical significance in the commission's October 8th meeting.
The Mitchell brothers built a handful of brick commercial block buildings along South Walnut in the 1920s. These buildings, crowned proudly with the stamp of their builders, are part of the architectural fingerprint of the city and form a recognizable pattern along its southern corridor. The two-story section with the M emblazoned on the top represents an era of immense growth and prosperity for our city and for our nation. It is one of the few survivors from that time that embodies in its materials and features the architectural legacy of the Roaring Twenties.
Commission member Deb Hutton said the building represents Bloomington restaurant history. Petitioner Josh Allen requested a full demolition to make way for new development, but recommended a historical plaque.
We'd be more than happy to put up a plaque and reference all the stuff that Connor just read. We would do our best to repurpose the limestone and as much of the brick on the front facade in the new building as we possibly could. The new front would be of a brown nature, a brown color tone. All that is no issues on our part. Our main driving force as far as, you know, the petition that we had is the building is beyond repair. And so it's not that you know, we want to just tear down as many buildings as we can. That's not the nature here. It's just this building is beyond salvage.
Commissioner Chris Sturbaum requested the building facade be preserved, but Alley stated fully salvaging the facade would not be feasible. Commissioner Doug Bruce said the now deteriorated building has seen a multitude of changes throughout its history.
This building has changed so much over time that I'm not sure what point in time we're looking at now is as historic as some of the other lovely pictures, specifically when the Boxmans had this building and their restaurant. I like some of the things that the petitioner is going to do as far as a plaque and trying to repurpose as much as he can. Part of me that has really struggled with this is I'm not so sure that the council would find enough here to move towards designation. I'm still not in agreement that this is a Mitchell building. You know, there's so much that has changed with brick and no brick and glass and all of the things on the building that I would want to see or that we have seen in some of the other Mitchell buildings. And then finally, my final comment is that, you know, I'm still looking at this thinking, is this building as it sits right now more historic than the Chocolate Moose structure? Again, another restaurant along the same block that we allowed to be removed.
Community member Janice Sorby noted that not many buildings remain from the 1920s. Commission members ultimately forwarded the demolition delay to the Bloomington Common Council for consideration of historical designation. Members Doug Bruce and Jeff Golden voted against, while Sam DeSolar abstained.
Bloomington City Council Transportation Committee discussed a replacement of the neighborhood's traffic safety program with the Traffic Calming and Greenways program. Bicycle and pedestrian coordinator Mallory Rick Biel said incomplete streets are a public safety concern. She spoke during the October 7th meeting.
Well, when we say incomplete streets, what we're talking about is streets that have one user in mind, drivers, instead of a range of users, which includes bicyclists, pedestrians. We have a lot of incomplete streets, or we have incomplete streets in our communities, and many of them look much like the residential streets that I just showed you. The single user may have not been the intent of the design of the street. However, that has become the outcome.
Rick Biel reported low-income households are most assessed from incomplete streets. She mentioned potential traffic calming tools could be speed cushions, bump outs, pavement markings, and signage.
We would allocate about $50,000 for this program in the year, and that would purchase about 10 pairs of these asphalt speed cushions that I had mentioned, which we imagine would be about two projects per year.
Planning Services Manager Beth Rosenbarger said the current neighborhood process to slow traffic requires too high of a participating voter threshold to allow city council overview. Council member Isabel Piedmont-Smith asked Rick Biel about the city council involvement.
Another big change here is that the street segments that receive traffic calming will not be in city code. And so the city council will not have to approve application of traffic calming measures. Is that correct?
That is correct, yes. They are the way that it's written is they need approval for removal, but not installation.
Rick Biel said traffic calming procedures could be initiated from the lesser of 51% of households or 24 households. Rosenbarger mentioned material costs would be used from the Alternative Transportation Fund. Council members unanimously recommended do pass to the council at whole.
Now it's time for a few minutes with the mayor. In today's segment, Mayor John Hamilton talks about the future of the farmers market, a new COVID-19 testing site, and early voting in Monroe County. All that and more in today's edition of A Few Minutes with the Mayor.
Community members posted questions on our social media via Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, posing questions to Bloomington Mayor John Hamilton about current issues. Today, on A Few Minutes with the Mayor, John Hamilton answers these questions. So our first question today is coming from the user Chocolate Priestess, and they say, the city needs to make a clear decision on Halloween. Simply telling us to look at CDC guidelines is not enough. Every year the city gives the dates, hours, and directions to those who want to celebrate to do so safely. Parades of kids in costumes, leaving treats on tables in individual bags, only in-house party gatherings with a limited number, drive-through routes to look at decorations. What is specifically allowed and when, where, and how?
Well, I appreciate the question about Halloween, and it is true that this year it is and should be different from usual years. Usually the city does set out hours for trick-or-treating door-to-door. I actually do think the city is not going to say, here are the hours to do door-to-door trick-or-treating, because I don't really think that's probably advisable. The CDC guidelines, which again, I would steer people toward, we do view door-to-door trick-or-treating as not advisable in this time and with what we're going through. So we did decide this year to really let the county health department direct our behaviors on Halloween. There are a lot of options for people. They can do private party household events, carving pumpkins, decorating, of course, is fine. But I really think the city is not likely to suggest certain hours for trick-or-treating door-to-door because we won't be doing that. I don't think I'll be doing it that at my house. And the CDC guidelines basically suggest that's a relatively high-risk activity, however it's done. So there are events. You can go on the city website. Parks and Recreation is doing a storytelling event, scary stories, and some other things that will be appropriately designed in light of COVID. But it's just going to be different this year, and people are going to want to figure out how they think their household can best honor the holiday. I will say, as a personal note, sometimes things that are meant to be safer or not, for example, when we did pumpkin carving in the backyard, one member of my family had to go to the hospital because of a knife cut. So be careful in all that you do. It's not just the virus that can be dangerous.
So I guess for the suggested activities like the costume parades or the bags of candy outside, is that something that like neighborhood associations should kind of come up with for their areas, if that's something they would want to do?
Yes, I think it's fine for individual households or groups of households or neighborhoods who may want to organize a viewing party of decorations or create a map. You know, I remember people, we did that pets in the window for people to encourage their children to look for when walking around in the spring. And those kinds of things are terrific and can be organized by different folks. But the city, we're not, I don't believe we'll be creating hours for those events. Different people may want to do it differently. And this is a year for creativity. So let your creativity roll. Just try to pay close attention to the guidelines to protect everyone's health.
All right. So the next question that I have is coming from user Susie Indiana. And they're asking, what can we do to restore our wonderful farmers market?
Well, thanks for the question about the farmers market. We actually are seeing an increase in attendance at the farmers market. It's been a couple of years of change for the farmers market. Certainly, many people are aware of last year that we had protests and issues that arose related to the farmers market. And of course, this year, COVID dramatically changed how the farmers market could and should operate. We continue to operate that market through October downtown. And that will continue leading up to the holiday market, actually, even into November. So watch for that. And, you know, well over 1,000, 2,000 people are buying their groceries at the downtown farmers market. It's an evolution, and COVID has certainly caused that change. We're continuing to look at how to increase and support local agriculture. Part of our Recover Forward investments actually do focus on local agriculture, and both through farmers market, but also through some other things we're exploring that may be an everyday market that's available for larger purchases of local food. And the best thing you can do is keep trying to find places that work for you to
to buy local food. It's really important to support our local agriculture, our farmers, but also a part of our climate change response and resilience as a community to have a vibrant local agriculture sector. So we'll keep working on that.
And will the farmers market move to an indoor location this year? And if so, where would that be?
Well, the city-run market operates the 8 months, kind of April through October. And that will continue to be, that's the case this year. We'll, in the off season, look at decisions and options for next year. There is a privately run, a non-city run, privately run winter market that last winter was operated in the pavilion at the Switchyard Park, and I believe will be operating again at the pavilion. That is done on city property, but it's run by an independent nonprofit. So look for word about that again on Saturdays in the winter. And there may be other indoor opportunities because we all need to keep trying to get local food during the winter too.
So the next question that I have is, a COVID-19 testing site is hoped to open in Bloomington later this month. What does this mean for the residents and their access to COVID-19 testing?
We all know how important testing is for COVID. I'm still frustrated we don't have a better national and state program to support all of that. So every county, including ours, has to kind of come up with a plan. But I am very pleased that we're collaborating closely. City, county, health, IU, health, Indiana University have all come together to help extend the state-supported testing site. So the state helps stand up testing sites. OptumServe ran them. They're free. They're available to anyone who's an Indiana resident. And we're going to try to keep that going. The state has indicated locals need to develop that plan ourselves. It's been a bit of a challenge, but it looks like we'll be able to stand that up, which will mean any individual can go to get a test at this site. We'll share the hours and the location in the weeks ahead. But it's something that we have needed to respond locally. Again, I really do think this should have been a national or at least a statewide push to make sure every community had this. The state is providing some money, but it's really important to have that local testing capacity. So this is a bunch of us collaborating locally to make sure that happens.
And is this testing site also going to be a lab? So would results come quicker as this is opening, or would it still be sent out to Indy?
The site itself, I don't believe, will have lab facilities, but we are working to identify the quickest, best way to get results, whether that's through a private lab, wherever they're located. We're actually talking to Indiana University to see whether they might have lab capacity, because as the question suggests, getting quick results is really important, and that's been another challenge nationally and statewide. So we're working on that. We don't quite have that locked down, but we know how important it is to try to get quick test results so that everybody can get that information to use as we should.
The last question that I have for you today is, how has the turnout been for early voting?
Well, from what I understand, it's been very high. We've had nearly 1,000 people the first day and second day. I haven't seen data lately, but I do believe this started last Tuesday, October 6th, I believe, was the first day of early voting. And I do encourage everybody who can to vote early in person. It's safe. They're very careful protocols. And I think we've had a very high turnout so far locally. And the more people can vote early, the better for us to get the count done and get the results in quickly. So check it out and show up. It'll be open through, I think, about noon on the Monday before Election Day. So that's November 2nd.
Do you have a question for Mayor John Hamilton? Comment that question on this coming week's post for a few minutes with the mayor to have your question answered. For WFHB, I'm Sydney Foreman.
You've been listening to the WFHB Local News. Today's headlines were written by Aaron Conforti, Cade Young, and Sydney Foreman in partnership with CATS, Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Sydney Foreman.
Our theme music is provided by Mark Bingham and the Social Climbers. Executive producer is Cade Young. For WFHB, I'm Sarah Vaughn.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org.
Stay tuned for With Good Reason, coming up next on WFHB.